Now we're going to read from Ephesians chapter 5. Now we began this study last week, and this is really part two of a two-part study. In fact, I have to say, those of you who are hoping we were going to get on to 6 verses 1 to 4 this morning, children and parents are likely to be disappointed. That's going to have to wait till next week, I think, so it may even be part two of a three-part story. Let me take up the reading where we ended it last week, in verse 25 of Ephesians 5, though you'll see the whole passage we're looking at begins at verse 21. Verse 25, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and become united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. Psychologists, doctors, schoolmasters and clergymen put over so much soppy propaganda about the virtue of a united family life, most of us have the idea the family is a universal institution, the very foundation of organized society. This isn't so. Human beings at one time or another have managed to invent all sorts of different styles of domestic living, and we shall invent more in future. That is Dr. Edmund Leach, a scholar of this university, delivering the Reef Lectures 25 years ago. In his view, the family was already, in the late 1960s, showing signs of acute terminal decay. Social evolution was moving on and rendering the family extinct in the process, he said. The permissive society was writing its death warrant. Many voices have been raised in the 25 years since he voiced that opinion, in support both of his charge and of the change which it reflects. Radical psychotherapists, for instance, like R.D. Lang and David Cooper, were arguing in the 1970s that the family was the source of major mental illness, like schizophrenia. The family, they said, is a vicious, emotionally damaging institution that cruelly penalizes those who will not conform to its stereotyping manipulation. Radical feminists were just as hostile to the family. What does the family do to us women, asks Juliet Mitchell in her book Woman's Estate, again written in the early 70s. It produces a tendency to small-mindedness, petty jealousy, irrational emotionality, and random violence. It produces dependency, possessiveness, passivity, and conservatism. These qualities are not simply the product of male chauvinism, they are the result of women's objective conditions within the family. And of course there has been a vogue in the last few years among many men also, egged on perhaps by the hedonistic philosophy of Hugh Hefner's Playboy magazine, to see family life as a drag, a formidable shackle upon their male freedom, confining them to an unremitting boredom. The phrase you hear on many young men's lips about marriage speaks volumes. I don't want to be tied down. Get the metaphor. No, says Hefner, girls that are having fun with. Why should you limit yourself to just one of them? That being tied down. Well, though these negative attitudes derive from, of course, very different interest groups, I think you'll notice if you think about it, that in fact the central complaint they have against the family in all three cases is the same. They're all suggesting that the family is in one way or another oppressive. Oppressive to children, oppressive to women, and according to Hugh Hefner, oppressive to men too. One is reminded of Ambrose Bierce's definition of marriage. Marriage, he says, is a condition of community consisting of a master, a mistress, and two slaves, making in all two. And it's against that perceived bondage, I think, many radicals and trendies of the 70s have more recently found themselves joining the ever-expanding orbit of New Age thought on this issue. For New Age, as we outlined earlier in this series of studies, amongst all its occultist and mystical speculations, is hugely concerned with self-fulfillment. That's one of its major planks of appeal and popularity. Every one of us, it says, has a personal spiritual quest to complete. We have to find our own route to enlightenment, to cosmic consciousness. And we must be free to pursue that quest. The problem with conventional marriage and family life is that it fences us in. It deprives us of the personal space we need to grow. So children are stunted by the family, condemned to a kind of emotional dwarfism. And men and women are stunted by the family, forced unwillingly into the cramping roles of housekeeper and breadwinner when they need to do something and be something else to find themselves. So now, at the end of the 20th century, there is a gathering tide of opinion which looks forward to a new kind of society, where human beings at last will discover the liberty to pursue their own star, to find their own yoga, their own pathway to spiritual fulfillment. And if the family is a casualty in that quest for personal and social transformation, so be it, says New Age. For as Esmond Leach said in his Promethean Humanist Arrogance in 1967, human beings have invented all sorts of different styles of domestic living, and we shall invent more in the future. Well, says New Age, that future is imminent. Well, you won't be surprised when I tell you that I have a big problem with all of that. Popular, though such anti-family apologetic has become in this century, particularly in the last quarter of it, I don't believe the family is a disposable institution, or that social evolution will ever render it extinct. And last Sunday, I hope you were here, but if you weren't, you can buy the tape. Last Sunday, we tried to outline some of the reasons for that. Maybe I should just recap slightly what they were. First of all, there's the study of history. Whenever attempts have been made to eliminate the family, those attempts have conspicuously failed. We cited the examples of revolutionary Soviet society in the early kibbutzim, you may remember, to illustrate the point. In fact, sociologists do observe that the family is a universal institution. That was the conclusion arrived at by G.P. Murdoch in a classic study of this subject in the late 40s, based on observation of 250 societies around the world. The anthropologist Margaret Mead, a very eminent person in her field, puts it this way: no matter how many communes anybody invents, the family always creeps back. And the Bible is not surprised about that. As we began to say last week, according to the Bible, marriage and family are not transient evolutionary developments of human society. They are part of the creation order. They're programmed into human nature from the beginning. We can never escape that kinship structure any more than we can run away from our own shadows. Men and women will always want to pair bond, and they will always want to raise their own children. This is the way we're made. And no amount of political indoctrination or social engineering or New Age propaganda is ever going to unmake us in this respect. But does that mean, then, that we can be optimistic about the future of the family? Does it mean we ought to be dismissive of radical talk of its imminent extinction? No, I fear it doesn't mean that at all. For the fact is, this ethos of self-fulfillment, which informs so much of late 20th century attitudes, and in particular fuels the popularity of the New Age movement, this ethos of self-fulfillment is generating, if not the loss, the abolition of the family, it is generating more and more dysfunctional families, more and more broken families, more and more unhappy families. People will go on looking for marital happiness and the ideal family. But while the ethos of self-fulfillment holds the center of the stage, they are going to find it painfully elusive. Now again, those of you here last week Well, remember that we said the Apostle Paul, in this passage of Ephesians that we're looking at, puts his finger on the reason for this in 5:21. Submit to one another, he says, out of reverence for Christ. In any pattern of human relationships, if it's going to succeed, one particular moral quality is needed more than any other, he says. Not love, although that might well have been what we would have expected Paul to extol in this context, but rather humility. Submit to one another, he says, out of reverence for Christ. We suggested last week that this whole section of Ephesians, from 5:22 through to 6:9, gives us three practical examples of human relationships where such humility, such submissiveness, is vitally necessary to social order and happiness. And significantly, the first two are both found within the family circle, the husband-wife relationship, the parent-child relationship. Both these relationships are asymmetric in structure. Again, we said this last week, there's a stronger party and a weaker party, one whose function is to lead and the other whose function is to accept leadership. We pointed out last week that asymmetry doesn't imply inequality of human worth, but it does imply complementary of social function, complementarity of social function. We spent some time, you may remember, dealing with the controversial issue of whether this asymmetry within the marriage bond was a purely cultural phenomenon of the first century, or whether it's intrinsic in marital relationships as part of the ordained creator's order. And against some in the Christian feminist lobby, I sought to defend the view that male leadership in marriage is, according to the Bible, a transcultural universal principle, reflecting, among other things, as Paul argues in this very passage, the leadership which Christ exercises towards the church. Now, for any of you who weren't here last week and for whom that is a major problem, I do beg you to get hold of that tape, because we can't just spend time establishing the point today, and you really can't interpret the rest of this passage unless you are convinced that what Paul is saying here about male leadership in the marriage bond applies to us just as much as to his original audience. So if you're in doubt about that, maybe you'd be better to just switch off, or at least try not to get too angry for the rest of today, and get hold of that tape and listen to it and see if you find it in the least convincing. What Paul then is saying generally here about family relationships is that they cannot work without the acceptance of this principle of submissiveness. They cannot work without humility. The problem with Edmund Leach and his humanist attack on the family, the problem with R.D. Lang and his psychotherapeutic attack on the family, the problem with Juliet Mitchell and her feminist attack on the family, the problem with Hugh Hefner and his hedonistic attack on the family, the problem with New Age and its indifference to the faith of the family. In every case, the problem with these things and these people is that they do not value humility. All of them are encouraging a fundamentally self-indulgent attitude that puts self-fulfillment at the top of the agenda. Do your own thing. You don't have to accept any controlling environment that hampers your personal freedom to find yourself, whatever that means. Well, frankly, family relationships cannot survive such attitudes. For a husband, his role is to lead the wife, and her role is to be led by the husband. For parents, their role is to lead the children, and for children, their role is to accept the leadership of their parents. And without humility, such asymmetric structures cannot work. That's why humility is such a vital moral quality. As we said last week, in the absence of humility, either the stronger party abuses their authority within the family relationship and oppresses the weak, or the weaker party resents their subordination in the family relationship and rebels against the strong. Or in some cases, of course, both happen and feed off one another. Only mutual humility can keep such a pattern of family life happily working. And Paul is convinced it should be no mystery for Christians, this. Humility should be accessible to Christians, this. For Christians follow a master who exhibited himself precisely such a quality of humility in his own ministry. I am meek and lowly in heart, he said. I did not come to be served, but to serve. So, he says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Anybody who is devoted to Christ should have no problem coping with asymmetric relationships. Your relationship with Christ is such an asymmetric relationship. Well, what I want us to do this week, then, is to observe in more practical terms the conclusions Paul draws from this. What does it actually mean, in practical terms, to function properly in this way within family relationships? Paul doesn't leave this merely at the level of abstract theory, you see, in this passage. He brings it down to some very concrete behavioral issues. And once again, perhaps we shall find ourselves in some sensitive areas as we discuss it. But I don't think we should duck the Bible's instruction on this matter. As we've already said, more and more families are characterized by unhappiness in our late 20th century. And in my view, only a rediscovery of Christian humility can possibly repair the tragic situation that many are facing, the emotional lacerations which are being inflicted on many as a result of that. Let's look then, first of all, at what he has to say about the relationship of husband and wife. As I say, we're going to have to leave children and parents until next week. You'll see this section 522 through to 533 really breaks into three. First with the advice to wife in verse 22 to 24, then with the advice to husband in verse 25 to 30, and then there's a sort of summary comment in which the creational institution of marriage generally is reaffirmed in verses 31 to 33. The first thing I want you to notice is that Paul's advice to husbands and wives is not identical. Look at verse 22 and then at verse 25. Wives, he says, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church. I think it is important to note Paul's choice of two different verbs there, submit and love. Some commentators have tried to suggest that this principle of mutual humility, which Paul speaks of in verse 21, implies that all of us should on all occasions seek to play a submissive role. Now, I don't believe that's what Paul means. In fact, you only have to think about it to realize what nonsense it would become. I'm reminded of that old joke, what's the slowest thing in the world? The slowest thing in the world is three Christians trying to get through the same door. After you, old man. No, after you. No, I insist, after you. That's people, you see, obeying 5:21 as if it meant, on all occasions, seek to play a submissive role. If that's what Paul had meant by mutual submission, he would have said, wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, submit to your wives. But no. Fact is, it can't be like that. Paul is not suggesting here that mutual submission means the abdication of all leadership roles. On the contrary, it is precisely the fourth of this passage, that the husband has had such a leadership role in the relationship. In fact, no group, no human group can adequately function or achieve any common goals without leadership. There's a whole science of cybernetics which has been developed in the last half century that clearly demonstrates why this is so. Every organized system, from whether you're talking about the management structure of a commercial company or the physiological structure of the human nervous system, all organized systems require a hierarchy of command, a line of communication. To use the phrase we used last week, they require an authority structure. In the absence of authority structures, organized systems fail to work. Either you get the all Indians and no chiefs syndrome. In other words, they are paralyzed by indecision. Or you get the all chiefs and no Indians syndrome. That is, they disintegrate into anarchy. According to Paul, marriage fits into this general pattern of all organized systems. It is an asymmetric relationship. It has to be. It wouldn't work properly if it wasn't. Hence his choice of asymmetric vocabulary to describe the respective roles of wife and husband within the relationship. Husbands, their role, he says, is to take the lead, as Christ takes the lead in regard to the church. He is its head, he says. So he chooses the verb love to express the nature of that leadership. Again, notice the analogy he uses to amplify the kind of love he's talking about. Love your wives as Christ loved the church. We use the word love, of course, in various ways. Sometimes we use the word love in a rather contemplative, passive way. But that is not the kind of love that Paul is talking about here. In fact, it is not the meaning of the word agape as New Testament writers use it generally. The distinctive thing about the love of Christ is that it is a love which takes the initiative, which takes the lead. Christ did not passively wait for us to come to him. That's the whole point. He actively came seeking for us. So too, says Paul, it is the husband's role in emulation of Christ always to be taking loving initiatives towards his partner. He is to be the leader in their relationship, a loving leader. By contrast, he says, it is the wife's role to accept his leadership, to be affirming and cooperative in her response to his initiative. So he uses the word for her, submit. She is to submit to him in the same way that the church submits to Christ in his demonstration of love for her. There are only two alternatives, you see, to such an asymmetric model of love and submission. There is the all Indians and no chief syndrome of marital paralysis. We've all seen marriages like this. Two people who can never make up their minds about anything because they're always waiting for the other person to make it up for them. Haven't you met couples like that? The other syndrome is the all chiefs and no Indians one. Marital anarchy. Two strong-minded individuals, each pursuing their own ego trip in complete defiance of the other. One sees marriages like that too. Let's not misunderstand Paul on this. In fact, let me hasten to make a couple of qualifying remarks, partly by way of response to some of the objections you were making, or some of you were making, to my sermon last week. I don't believe Paul here intends to give any solace to men who beat their wives. Physical violence against anybody is immoral. In my view, it ought to be a criminal offence. Wives should have exactly the same protection under the law of the land from assault by their husbands as by any other member of the public. If you ask what should a battered wife do, well, of course she's in a most difficult position. Who can deny it? But it does seem to me that when authority is grossly abused, sometimes the oppressed, weaker party has no alternative but to abandon their submissive role in their own self-defense and seek some kind of escape or protection or legal redress. In my view, the position of a battered wife or an abused child in this respect is not unlike the position of an exploited employee or an oppressed Negro. All such people are entitled to appeal to a higher court, and in my view, though not all Christians would agree with this, I believe in extremis they are entitled to rebel physically against those responsible for their personal misery. If the state fails to fulfill its God-given function in the protection of the weak, then sometimes the weak may have no other course than to protect themselves. There's that saying, isn't there? It takes two to tango. Authority structures only work when both stronger and weaker party responsibly fulfill their role. I think it's thoroughly unfair to suggest that the onus for maintaining harmony and unity in a relationship falls wholly on the weaker party in doing its submissive bit properly. On the contrary, Paul would say the onus falls far more on the stronger party in doing their loving and caring and nurturing role properly. Revolutions are, in the vast majority of cases, due to the abuse of power rather than due to any instinctual sort of bolshiness on the part of those who are being oppressed. So I don't think personally Paul's words should be construed as blanket support for reactionary conservatism against all forms of liberation movement. In my view, there are times when you can't follow God's ideal as you would wish to do. You only have the lesser of two evils to choose between. And a battered wife, therefore, may well feel divorce is the only way out of her evil situation, even though she doesn't approve of divorce. More generally, I don't believe Paul is here suggesting that in any disagreement between a husband and wife, the husband should always expect to get his own way. Quite the contrary. If anything, Paul's implication here is rather reverse of that. For it is, he says, husband's duty to love their wives. That's what humility means for the husband. He's not merely passively let her tell him what to do. He's not to do that, surely. But rather, he's actively to seek her welfare on his own initiative. If he is to love her as Christ loved the church, then his love must not be a self-gratifying one, but a self-sacrificial one. It's not a cringing servility, then, that Paul is enjoining on wives, but supportive respect for loving husbands. What's that going to mean in practice? What will it mean for the wife that Paul says, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord? Well, I can only make a very few tentative suggestions. I would have thought that it ruled out rank disobedience, wouldn't you? I know you told me I shouldn't buy it, but it was such a bargain. My husband will be hopping mad if he finds out I did this, but I couldn't resist it. Doesn't it mean, too, stepping back from having a row with him about things? If rows become habitual, you know, husbands, generally speaking, are provoked into one of two responses. Either a primitive demonstration of their physical superiority, either against household china, or even against the person of their wives. So as I've already said, I don't support that. But if they don't do that, then what often happens is that they withdraw into a kind of uncommunicativeness for the sake of peace and quiet. Haven't you seen husbands behave like that? Either way, the prospect for the marriage is not good. What else does it mean that wives submit to their husbands as to the Lord? Well, I suspect it means that a wife will not nag her husband. The dripping tap kind of picture is one that, again, has been caricatured endlessly. And unfortunately, it's true sometimes. If by some unfortunate chance the husband has proven to have made a mistake in the past, there are some wives who will resurrect that liberally furnished with "I told you so" and "if only you'd listen to me" on every possible occasion when a parallel situation arrives. A few years of that are usually more than enough to make a man prefer the pub to his own home this evening. I suspect wives submitting to your husbands as to the Lord will also eliminate that sort of self-pity tactic. You know, the handkerchief coming out, the tears down the eyes, the whining sob, "You never really loved me." Most husbands are guaranteed to fall for that one once or twice. Then they realize they're being manipulated, and their sympathy turns to sarcastic indifference. What other things are eliminated by wives submit to your husbands? Well, it eliminates complaining to the children about him, doesn't it? "Yes, dear, but your father says so, and we all know he's as infallible as the Pope." It eliminates gossiping to other women about him, doesn't it? It eliminates seeking your mother's support against him, doesn't it? Or his mother's support against him, come to that. It eliminates punishing refusals to have sexual relations with him, doesn't it? It eliminates that sulky and resentful attitude that bangs around the house in a bad temper, letting it be known that you disapprove. They're none of us strangers to this kind of thing. What God is calling, I think, us to recognize in this passage is that it's fundamentally unchristian behavior. Would any of us dare to be so churlish and quarrelsome with Christ? Well then, said Paul to wives, don't behave like that with your husbands. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Saviour. As the church submits to Christ, so wives should submit to their husbands in everything. He is the leader. That's his role. You should support him. But what about the husband? What does that verb love mean in practical terms for him? When Paul says in verse 25, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church. Well, clearly that means he is not to see his wife as a doormat, whose opinions he can trample upon and ignore. No, rather, says Paul, he is to see her as a most precious treasure to be nurtured and cared for. He is to solicit her needs. He is to seek at all times to meet those needs at the cost of his own preferences and of his own convenience. For Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. This is the model of love that Paul is using here, a generous love. I wonder, those of us who are husbands here, when was the last time we actually did anything which really involved any degree of personal sacrifice for our wives? They say, you know, that marriage is the highest compliment a man can pay a woman, and usually the last. Paul's urging here a generosity of heart, which is constantly providing costly evidence of the appreciation that we feel for our wives. Through words, through gifts, through gestures. Most of all, she needs to know that her husband is a man who is willing to put himself second to her interests, as Christ was willing to put himself second to our interests, giving himself up for us. She needs to know that he is not a person who uses his leadership role as a whip or as a bludgeon. Not only is it a generous love, Paul, expanding on this a little further, points out what an exclusive love it is. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle. This is the language of sanctification, of holiness, Paul's using here. He's saying Christ treats the church in an utterly unique way. He sets her apart for himself. He invests a love in her which he offers to nobody else, a special love reserved for his own people. Normally, in a Jewish wedding, the best man gave the bride away. But Paul seems to suggest here that Jesus won't trust the church to a best man. He's his own matchmaker. He prepares her for the wedding day himself. He presents her to himself. His relationship with her is utterly exclusive. She has absolutely no grounds for jealousy, because he has eyes only for her. There are many men, of course, who think that they can love more than one woman simultaneously. That's nonsense when you're talking about love of this sort. It's possible to have sexual affairs with more than one woman simultaneously, but the sort of love that Christ exemplifies is far too intense, far too exclusive to be dissipated in that sort of promiscuous way. And there are many more men, of course, who, even if they remain technically faithful to their wives, engage in silly flirtation, thinking it macho to have a roving eye in the street, make their wives perhaps privately weep because of their insensitive comparisons of her looks with that nice secretary at the office, or ogling page 3 of the Sun conspicuously at the breakfast table. Now, the love of Christ demands a love which the wife knows is hers and hers alone, that she is utterly special. She feels she is special to her husband. He makes her feel like £1 million because she knows that's what she's worth to him. More than that, says the apostle, if we are to love, we husbands, as Christ loved the church, it must be a considerate love, presenting her to himself without stain or wrinkle. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own body, but feeds and cares for it. Jesus, says Paul, is concerned about the appearance of his bride. He doesn't want her looking dowdy or ill. He doesn't want her looking worn out or burdened with anxiety. He wants her to look healthy and beautiful. And he provides for her needs so that she can look that way. In the same way, he says, husbands ought to care for their wives. What does that mean? Oh, it means all sorts of things. Too many things to list, really. It means, for a start, I think, no meanness with money. No doubt it is right for husbands to take primary responsibility for budgeting of the domestic account as part of their leadership role. But that doesn't mean the wife must find herself burdened because she's not able to buy clothes or cosmetics. Because he doesn't think it's very important. We can't afford it, dear. So we can always afford petrol for the car, of course. Self-esteem is very important for women. It ought not to be crippled by the parsimoniousness of her husband's wallet. Perhaps most of all, this caring ministry is about trying to take the trouble to understand her. Because she is so different from us, isn't she? This woman we've married. Maybe there's more anxiety in her personality than in yours. I'll try to understand it and reassure her instead of mocking her fears in that contemptuous way. Maybe she's a more emotionally dependent person than you are. Then try to understand that and provide the warmth and the tenderness she needs instead of cold shouldering her. Maybe she suffers from a sort of inferiority complex, living in your shadow. After all, you're the one who's got the big career. She's just the little lady at home. Society doesn't give great esteem to wives and mothers, does it? Well, then try to make her feel the importance of what she's doing. One way you can do that, I suppose, is by listening, isn't it? And not whipping her into silence every time she tries to contribute to the conversation, but rather encouraging her with the sense that she really is a valuable person in this relationship. Maybe she feels resentful of being tied to the home all day. Maybe she feels neglected and lonely. Well, then take her out, for goodness sake. Maybe she finds the children difficult and exhausting. Well, then give her a break from the children. Maybe she feels guilt-ridden and inadequate because she doesn't live up to the image of the ideal wife she gains from sermons like this. Well, then keep praising her. Telling her she's doing just great. Caring takes a thousand forms in practical everyday business of living together. Very few women in my pastoral experience leave their husbands because they are sexually dissatisfied. Very few women leave their husbands because they are irresistibly attracted to some other man. When the woman takes the initiative in leaving home, it is usually because she's feeling unbearably neglected. Uncared for. Now, let me hasten to add, it is with considerable embarrassment I speak like this to husband, being one myself. Jane is in the congregation. I haven't dared to look at her face throughout this entire sermon. I couldn't bear the smirk which I'm sure I would see her. And I'm certainly not parading myself as some kind of model husband to you. Jane will quickly disabuse you of any such misconception if you ask her afterwards. Now, I find myself rebuked by a passage like this, as I'm sure every other husband here does. But, you know, we can't make excuses for ourselves. Of course we fail. Of course we find ourselves embarrassed by much of what Paul says to us. But we can't blame our failure on others. We can't blame the unhappiness of our marriages, if there is unhappiness there, upon current friends We can't even blame the feminists, you know. Now, if our marriages are unhappy, we must take the lion's share of the blame for that unhappiness. For we are the leaders God has appointed in the marital relationship. It's our responsibility to make our marriages happy. The buck stops with us. We are responsible for the happiness of our families. We are responsible for the happiness of our wives. We are to be leaders in our marriages, but loving leaders. Generous leaders, faithful leaders, considerate leaders. Leaders who love as Christ loves the church. And I don't believe there is any woman who would find, who would be found complaining of their marital lot. I don't think there's any woman who would find it difficult to offer support and respect as a submissive wife if they were secure in the experience of such a loving leadership. Well, our time is going. Let's just look briefly at this summary with which Paul ends our passage. For this reason, he says, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, that I am talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. Paul is here drawing attention to those words in the book of Genesis, which define the nature of marriage as the creation norm. It's not a cultural adaptation. It's the way God has made us. He's reminding us. These words are full of importance, too much importance really to draw out here. It makes clear, for instance, this text from Genesis in verse 31, that marriages don't depend on parental approval. No doubt consent of one's parents is a very desirable thing, and a wise couple will always seek it. They'd be very concerned to know what their parents' reasons are if they deny parental consent. But marriage is essentially the creation of a new bond which takes precedence over loyalty to parents. Husband and wife are, though not blood related, next of kin, says Paul. They leave father and mother and are united to one another. The in-law problem, of course, only starts in marriages when that is forgotten. When a husband and a wife forget that they are closer to one another than they are to their parents. Another thing which this text from Genesis makes clear, which is important, is that marriages are not dependent upon the gift of children. Now, there are many societies in which a childless marriage can be legally nullified, not according to the Bible. Children are a super-added gift to a relationship. But Adam was given Eve for her own company, not for the sake of any children she might give to him. Marriage is complete with husband and wife. It also makes clear, this text, the importance of sex within marriage. For that phrase, become one flesh, quite clearly is a reference to sexual intercourse within the marital bond. That's how Paul interprets it, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 6. No doubt that sexual component in marital unhappiness is often exaggerated today. But we ought not to underestimate its importance either. For according to Scripture, it's that act of physical union which uniquely cements the marriage bond together and makes it a marriage. They become one flesh. This, of course, is why sex before marriage is such a big mistake. Because it is essentially a contradiction in terms. The irreversible step is not signing the marriage register. The irreversible step is entering the marriage bed. For the emotional and psychological union that is sealed by that sexual act is something nothing can undo. No judge can disentangle that one flesh bond. It's such an adhesive one. It can't be easily dissolved. It can't be dissolved at all, in fact. Those who have slept together will remember that partner for the rest of their lives. And if they come to some point in their lives where they want to give themselves to somebody else, they will find themselves haunted by that previous union. Husband and wife then are fused into a single new corporate entity by marriage. They are one flesh. They are quite literally part of one another. They're not to think of one another as two individuals any longer in a way, but as one. Husband the head, wife the body. So says Paul, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. This is a great mystery, he says. Not just the mystery of marriage, but the mystery of Christ's relationship to the church is bound up in it. But if you want to know what a happy marriage consists of, this is it, in summary. Love your wife, respect your husband. Socrates advised his young disciples, you know, by all means marry. If you get a good wife, you'll be happy. If you get a bad wife, you'll become a philosopher. Well, I fear he's right in this sense, that unhappy marriages are making many philosophers today. Unfortunately, it's breeding many cynics. People are losing confidence in the possibility of marital happiness. They keep on trying, but it seems to be an elusive will-o'-the-wisp. Well, I really don't believe it has to be. I really don't believe we have to give up on marriage. The problem is not with marriage. The problem is with the mindset of late 20th century Western men and women. We want self-fulfillment. While the spiritual truth of our human existence is that we cannot find self-fulfillment by that sort of direct ambition. If you put self-fulfillment first in your life, I guarantee you'll never achieve it. That's what's wrong with New Age. It's the classic dog chasing its own tail problem. No, the key to happy marriages, happy families, happy societies is to get self off the throne. Jesus showed us the spiritual truth when he came down off the throne to be born in a stable, laid in a manger, hung on a cross. That's what he meant when he said, he who tries to save his life will lose it. But he who throws his life away will find it. Stop looking for self-fulfillment. Pray instead for humility. The humility to fulfill your God-given roles in the relationships that God gives you, in the way he appoints. Happiness is to have the mind of Christ. And the mind of Christ, above everything else, is a humble mind. Let's pray together.